Matthew 17. Last week we looked at verses 14 through 21 where Christ taught the disciples the power of faith, or looking at it negatively, the powerlessness of faithlessness. And then we quickly ended with verses 22 and 23, where Christ, for the second time, at least the second time recorded in the Gospel of Matthew, Christ predicts his death and resurrection. I want to point out one item in verse 22. It says, "While they abode in Galilee, Jesus said unto them, The Son of Man shall be betrayed into the hands of men, and they shall kill him. Third day he shall be raised again," and they were exceedingly sorrowful. And we said last week that the first prediction of his death and resurrection in chapter 16, that's when Peter pulled Christ aside and rebuked Christ for saying such things. This time there's no rebuke. Simply says they were exceedingly sorrowful. So they're still not fully comprehending what's going on, but they know something's going on and it's not good. And they are exceedingly sorrowful. But notice where they are when Christ makes this prediction. He says, while they abode in Galilee. You don't need to turn to it, but in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 24, when Luke writes about the resurrection, says the women came to the sepulcher on the first morning of the week, and the stone was rolled away. There's no body there, and the angel says to them, "He is not here, but is risen. Remember how he spoke unto you when he was yet in Galilee, saying, The Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified, and the third day rise again." The angel makes reference to what Matthew is recording here in chapter 17. They were in Galilee, and he is saying that he'll be killed at the hands of sinful man and rise again the third day. And so at the resurrection, the angel tells the ladies, it happened just like he said it would happen when he was still in Galilee. Just a reference to this prediction here. In verse 24, when they were come to Capernaum, they that received tribute money came to Peter and said, "Does not your master pay tribute?" So now they're in Capernaum. Capernaum is in Galilee, so they haven't left Galilee, but they come to the city of Capernaum. Whose hometown was Capernaum? Who? Peter. This was Peter's hometown. And of course, Andrew is Peter's brother, so it was Peter and Andrew's hometown. Indication seems to be that it was James and John's hometown as well, because they were partners in the fishing industry. Matthew collected taxes for Rome in Capernaum. So this is home. And we understand Nazareth is where Jesus was raised early on in his life, but Capernaum really became kind of the center of his ministry. His earthly ministry was up in Galilee for the most part, and Capernaum was kind of the home base, if you will. It was Peter's hometown, James and John and Andrew's hometown. Apparently Matthew, if it wasn't his hometown, he certainly spent time there as a tax collector. So this was home. They're back home in that sense, back in Capernaum. And when you're back home, that's where you're going to pay your taxes. And so this one comes to Peter, and he says, "Does not your master pay tribute?" Now, the word tribute here, and your translation may actually say this, it's a two-drachma tax. A two-drachma tax. And the word tribute is the word didrachma, which means two-drachma. Drachma was a piece of coinage, and two-drachma was two of those pieces of coins. It was worth half a shekel, and that was, again, Jewish money, so you have one drachma, and then you have these two drachma, which equals half a shekel. And then there was not a two drachma piece of coinage, but there was a four drachma piece of coinage, which was a shekel. And that becomes important. I'm not just giving that for facts. That does become important as we go down through this. And so when he says, does your master pay the two drachma tax, he's making reference to a specific tax. And the tax he's making reference to is the temple tax. Everyone was to pay a temple tax, and that temple tax was equivalent to two drachma. And so that's what he's asking here. Does your master pay the two drachma temple tax? Now, this temple tax was not specifically leveled by Rome. It was permitted by Rome and sanctioned by Rome, but it was not levied by Rome. This was the local government, that is Israel's local government, which was primarily the Sanhedrin, which was also in charge of the temple. And so it was this temple tax levied by the Sanhedrin, sanctioned by Rome. Again, that all becomes rather important as we go down through this. Verse 25, Peter's answer is yes. That's all he says. Does your master pay the two drachma temple tax? Peter says yes. Obviously, this is towards the end of Christ's earthly ministry, and Peter had seen Christ pay this tax in the past. It was an annual tax. Peter had seen him pay the tax, so his answer was yes, he pays it. When he was come into the house, Jesus spoke first to him, saying, "What are you thinking, Simon? Of whom do the kings of the earth take custom or tribute, of their own sons or of strangers?" It says Christ spoke first. The word that's used here is really a word that means to anticipate. I think the scenario that we see here is Christ heard this question of Peter, "Does your master pay this temple tax?" And Peter answers yes. They go into the house. Christ is probably looking at Peter and recognizing Peter's got some questions here. Probably the way Peter answered that question, Christ knew that he was struggling with this. Why would the Messiah, the king, pay a tax? Peter's wheels are turning. Christ knows his wheels are turning. And so, anticipating a question from Peter, Christ speaks first. He doesn't even wait for Peter to ask the question. He speaks first. But Peter is thinking this through. He's the Messiah. He's the king. Why would he pay this temple tax? Think about it. He's the Messiah. He's the king. He's the Son of God. Christ has referred to the temple as my Father's house. Peter knows that Christ has already, on two different occasions, cleansed the temple because of such abuse that was taking place there in the temple. He knows that the Sanhedrin is the ones that are out to kill him. They're the ones in charge of the temple. Why would the Messiah pay the temple tax? Good question. I think my wheels would have been turning too. And so Jesus, anticipating Peter's questions about that, he raises a question. Do the kings of the earth take custom or tribute of their own sons or of strangers? The point is this. And the two words here, custom or tribute, they're two different words than what's used up in verse 21. The word custom here is basically what we would consider a sales tax. Here in Pennsylvania, it's a 6% sales tax. That's basically the custom that he's talking about here, a sales tax. The word tribute that's used in verse 25 is basically a poll tax. Every citizen paid that poll tax. And so he says, of whom does the king get this sales tax and this poll tax from? From the sons of the king or from others? The word strangers here is simply referring to those who are not part of the king's family. So does the king charge a tax to his own family or to those outside of his family? Well, Peter answers the question rightly so. He says unto him, of strangers or of those outside of his own family. Jesus said unto him, then are the sons free. The king's family, the king's sons, they don't pay a tax. It's the others outside of the family of the king that pays the tax. So what's Christ driving at here? He refers to the temple as my Father's house. He's the Son of God. In essence, he is saying to Peter, Peter, I understand your question. Why should I pay this tax? And in essence, he's saying to Peter, Peter, you're right. I have the right not to pay this tax. I'm the Son of God. I'm the Messiah. I'm the King. This is my Father's house. I should not have to pay that temple tax. I have a right not to do so. I believe that's what Christ is saying here. That's the point he's driving at. And so he's, in essence, saying to Peter, I understand your question. I understand why you're struggling with this. You're right. The sons of the king don't pay that tax. I'm the Son of God. This is my Father's house. I shouldn't have to pay this tax. And, in essence, he said, then are the sons free. Peter, why should you pay this tax? You're part of my family. Your citizenship is not here on this earth. You're looking forward to the kingdom. That's where your citizenship is. At this point, there's still kingdom mindset. They're not so much thinking heaven. We would look at it and say, well, we're citizens of heaven. Peter would be looking at it as, I'm a citizen of the kingdom. Why should I be paying this earthly tax by these men who are trying to kill you, who are in control of this corrupt temple system? Why should I pay that tax? In essence, Christ is saying, Peter, there's a sense in which you don't have the obligation to do that. You have a right not to pay that. Again, I believe that's what Christ is trying to get across to Peter. That makes sense? Any questions up to that point? We'll see what Christ says beyond that, but up to that point, does that make sense? In essence, what Christ is saying is, Peter, we have a right not to pay this tax. Notwithstanding, verse 27, or but. And I'm always pointing out that word, aren't I? But, lest we should offend them, go to the sea, cast an hook, and take up the fish that first comes up, and when you have opened its mouth, you shall find a piece of money, that take and give unto them for me and thee. Peter, go fishing. The first fish you catch, open its mouth, and you're going to find a piece of money. And in the Greek there, that phrase, piece of money, you're going to find a 4-drachma coin. Take that 4-drachma coin and pay the tax for you and for me. Again, remember, it was a 2-drachma tax. So he found this coin that was a 4-drachma piece of money, and he says, go pay the tax. What's Christ trying to teach Peter here? First and foremost, he's trying to teach Peter, Peter, you don't have to demand your rights. We have a right not to pay that. But I'm not going to demand my rights. And remember, as we're going through 1 Corinthians, especially get in chapters 8 and 9 there, we spent a lot of time on that. Paul instructed the church at Corinth, you know, we do have some rights, but we don't have to demand our rights. In fact, sometimes we have to surrender our rights for the cause of Christ. We have to surrender our rights so that we don't cause our brother to stumble. And that's what he says here. Notwithstanding, lest we should offend them. The word offend there is the word cause to stumble. We need to surrender our rights so that we don't cause others to stumble in their walk, to stumble into sin. You see, for Christ to insist on his rights would have caused others to sin. And so he says, I'm going to surrender my rights. I'm going to forego my rights. I'm not going to demand my right. I'm going to pay the tax. And Peter, you need to do the same thing. You don't need to demand. It's not wrong to pay the tax. Now, again, don't misunderstand. It's not like they were doing something wrong by paying the tax. They simply were not exercising their rights. And we need to understand that sometimes we have to surrender our rights. We don't need to exercise our rights. If it's going to cause our brother to stumble, then don't demand your rights and don't exercise it. And that's really what Christ is teaching Peter here. Go with me to 1 Peter. I think Peter learned his lesson very well. And I can't help but think that as Peter was writing 1 Peter chapter 2, he had this account in mind when he got that 4-drachma piece out of the fish's mouth and paid the tax. I think he had this in mind. But Christ was instructing Peter here to surrender your rights. But he's also saying, Peter, you need to submit to the governmental authorities. It wasn't necessarily a Roman tax, but it was sanctioned by Rome, but it was a local tax levied by the Sanhedrin, by the government, the local government there. And Christ is saying, you need to humble yourself and submit to that authority, even though you have a right not to. But Peter, in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9, you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, people of his own, that you should show forth the praises of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Notice that you're a chosen generation, you're a royal priesthood, you're a holy nation who in time past were not a people but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy but now have obtained mercy. Dearly beloved, I beseech you as sojourners and pilgrims. That's what we are here on this earth, aren't we? We're a chosen generation. We're a holy nation. This is not our home. We're strangers and pilgrims here. We're aliens here. We're not citizens here as much as we are citizens of heaven. And so that's what Peter's addressing here. We really are strangers and pilgrims here. This is not our home. And so he says, as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul. As you understand that you're a citizen of heaven, don't allow the flesh here on this earth to control you. Having your behavior honest among the Gentiles, that whereas they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works, which they shall behold, glorify God in the day of visitation. He says, now, as you understand that you are a citizen of heaven, you're a holy nation, you're just a stranger and pilgrim here on this earth, but understand your responsibility here on this earth. You have a responsibility as it relates to the people around you, not to cause them to stumble, but for them to see your good works and glorify God. And immediately then in verse 13, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man. So he says, yeah, you're a stranger and pilgrim here on this earth. This is not your home. This is not your citizenship. But guess what? You still need to submit to government authority. That's what Christ was teaching Peter there when he got the 4-drachma piece out of the fish's mouth. Peter, you are a son of God. You're a citizen of the kingdom. but you still need to submit to the authorities here on this earth. Submit yourself to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme or unto governors as unto them that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of them that do good. That's the government's job, to punish the evil and to praise the good. For so is the will of God, that with well-doing you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. You don't want to cause them to stumble. You want to point them to Christ. As free and not using your liberty for a cloak of maliciousness, but as the servants of God, honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. See, Christ says, submit yourself to the authorities, pay the tax, don't cause others to stumble, because what you want to do is draw them to Christ. You want to draw them to God. You want to be an example to them. And Peter, I think, is repeating that same thing here in 1 Peter chapter 2. He says, yeah, you're not a citizen here. You're a holy nation. But submit to that authority so that you can draw others to Christ. You have any questions about that? Yeah, Glenn. Yeah, his point was that Christ provided, seemingly as a miracle here, the money to pay that tax. And we don't have the privilege of performing a miracle to pay our taxes, do we? But Christ is simply teaching Peter here a lesson concerning submission to authority and surrendering your rights. And you know, when it comes to that surrendering our rights, that should just be constantly on our minds, I think. You know, it's so easy for us to just say, well, I have a right to do this, or I have a right to do that, or this is what's going to make me feel good, this is going to what make me feel happy, and I have a right to do it, and don't give a thought whatsoever as to how what we do affects those around us. And we need to be thinking about how it affects those around us. Every decision we make, we should be thinking, how is this going to impact people around me? Is it for their good, or is it going to cause them to stumble? We as parents or grandparents, when we make decisions, we need to be thinking about our kids and our grandkids. How is this going to impact them? How are they going to see what I'm about to do? Is this going to be for their good, or is it going to cause them to stumble? Not just in paying our taxes or even submitting to the government, but I'm looking at it in a much broader sense even. It's so easy to just get so self-focused, this is what I want to do. This is what's going to make me happy. This is going to make me feel good. And not give a thought as to how others are going to view that, how it's going to impact our kids or our grandkids. And that should be one of the first thoughts in our mind. Obviously, the first thought is it going to glorify God? But part of that, is it going to glorify God? It has to be. It's not going to glorify God if it's going to cause my kids or my grandkids or others around me to stumble. That needs to be one of the first thoughts we have on our mind when we decide to do something or not to do something. I'm not going to throw out a bunch of examples for you. You can come up with your own examples on that. I'd say even making decisions whether I go to church or not go to church on a particular Sunday morning. How's that going to impact my kids? They see me just being lazy and not wanting to go to church because I don't feel like it. That's going to impact my kids. Do I have a right not to go to church? Yep, you do. How's that impact your kids, your grandkids? That's just one simple example. We have rights. In our freedom in Christ, we have rights. But Christ teaches the disciples here, we need to surrender our rights if it's going to cause others to stumble. Any questions, comments? That takes a lot of humility, you know, for us to surrender our rights and do something that we have a right not to do. That takes humility. And we move right on into chapter 18 as Christ really continues to teach humility to the disciples. Remember, we're in this section now of the Gospel of Matthew where Christ is more and more focusing his teaching and his instruction on the disciples as opposed to the multitude. And so now he's teaching them on humility. As we said in verses 14 through 21, it was that the power of faith. But then here in verses 24 through 27, it really is about humility in surrendering our rights. And now he continues on this subject of humility as we move into chapter 18. At the same time, came the disciples unto Jesus, saying, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" We know from other accounts in the Gospels that this was kind of an argument among the disciples. They were arguing among themselves who of them was going to be the greatest. And, of course, remember James and John's mother actually came to Jesus and wanted to make James and John the greatest. This was kind of a discussion among the disciples. And so we have this discussion going on, apparently, as they were walking along the way there in Capernaum, and they're arguing among themselves who's going to be the greatest. And they decided, well, let's go ask the king himself. Let's go ask the boss. He'll settle the matter who's going to be the greatest. And probably as they came to him, they were all thinking to themselves, "I hope it's me." Jesus called a little child unto him, set him in the midst of them, said, "Verily I say unto you, except you be converted and become as little children, you shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven." Wow. He gets a little child and he sets this child in the midst of the disciples. He says, "Unless you be converted." And the word "converted" there is, it's just the word to be turned around, literally, simply to change. Unless you, basically what he said, unless you change your attitude, unless you change your attitude of pride and selfish ambition, you're not going to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. You're not even going to make it into the kingdom of heaven. You need to change your attitude. You need to change your pride and your selfish ambition. Become like this child, or else you're not even going to make it into the kingdom of heaven. And then, of course, he says in verse 4, "Whoever therefore shall humble himself as this little child, the same is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." That principle that he's taught elsewhere, "He who humbles himself shall be exalted, and he who exalts himself shall be abased," or humiliated. And he's saying the same thing here. You need to become like a child, childlike faith. He's not saying here that works saves you. He's not saying that. He's just emphasizing that you have to humble yourself in faith, humble yourself before the grace of God, humble yourself in faith, so that you will indeed be exalted by God himself. As he says, you won't even enter into the kingdom of heaven. Again, everyone who comes to Christ for salvation has to humble themselves. At least at that moment, they have to humble themselves. There can be no salvation apart from humility. At least to the point we have to humble ourselves before God and say, "I'm a sinner. I deserve nothing from you. Please save me." That's humility. And so he says, you're not even going to enter into the kingdom of heaven unless you get rid of that pride and that selfish ambition. Unfortunately, sometimes as believers, we do humble ourselves for salvation, but then later on, we become lifted up with pride again. We become arrogant again. But at least at the time of salvation, we do need to humble ourselves as a child and have childlike faith that simply surrenders oneself to the will of God and surrenders our eternal destiny into His hands. That's what salvation's all about. He says we need to become like a little child, and we need to continue to have that same childlike faith and that same childlike humility that needs to continue on through our Christian life, not just at the time of salvation, but we need to continue to humble ourselves so that God can exalt us rather than exalting ourselves. Verse 5 says, "Whosoever shall receive one such little child in my name receives me. Whosoever shall offend one of these little ones who believe in me, it were better for him that a millstone were hung about his neck and that he were drowned in the depth of the sea." Whosoever shall receive one such little child in my name receives me. That reminds me of the account in Matthew where Christ talks about the judgment of the nations that's yet to come, where he separates the goats from the sheep. And he says, you gave me food when I was hungry. You gave me a drink when I was thirsty. And he said, well, when did we feed you and when did we give you a drink? He said, as long as you did it unto one of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me. And the same principle here. If you receive or help a little child in my name, you're doing it as if you're doing it to me. So it's not just the idea of helping a little child just because you feel sorry for them. I mean, again, that's a good thing and that's part of it. But it is motivated by the fact that we're doing it in the name of Christ. And that's the emphasis here. What we do, are we doing it in the name of Christ? Are we doing it simply out of humanitarian reasons? Or are we doing it out of a cause for Christ, to glorify Him? We're doing it in His name. We're told that we're to do everything we do in the name of Christ. And so even helping a child, it should be in the name of Christ and for His sake. Not just, and again, don't misunderstand me, certainly we do it for the sake of the child, and we do it because we love that child, but it needs to be more than that. That's really what separates a believer in what he does and just somebody who's a humanitarian. They're doing it for the sake of that child and probably to receive some glory for themselves. We need to do it for the sake of the child, but for the sake of Christ and to bring glory to Him. And so that's what he's saying here. If you do it with that motive, indeed you're doing it in my name. But whosoever shall offend, there's that word again, you cause a child to stumble, better that you have a millstone hung around your neck and drowned in the sea. That's pretty strong words. That should cause every one of us as parents who have younger children especially, that should cause us to shudder. If I do anything that causes my child to stumble in their faith and to stumble in their sin, I'm better off having a millstone hung around my neck. That's pretty sobering words. But this whole context is about humility. It's about not causing others to stumble, even if it means surrendering our rights and making sure that what we do in the name of Christ and not just for selfish ambition and for out of pride. The whole context fits together with that word offend or cause to stumble. I need to be able to surrender my rights so I don't cause others to stumble. I need to make sure that what I do is in the name of Christ so that I don't cause others to stumble. I need to do it in humility, not with selfish ambition and pride. Do you have any questions or comments about that? It's a passage that kind of focuses around that word cause to stumble, and it doesn't stop there. We're going to have to stop there, but next week we'll get into the following verses, and it continues to talk about causing to stumble. The whole context is about that. Let's bow in prayer. Father, thank you so much again for this opportunity to be together tonight. Thank you for your love for us. I pray that we would examine our own hearts. Father, it's not easy to surrender our rights. We live in a society that demands rights. Help us to be different. Help us not to cause others to stumble because of our pride and our selfish ambition, but to humble ourselves before you and to do what we do in the name of Christ and for your sake and for your glory. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Good evening. Thanks for coming tonight.